Seattle's Morning News. Seattle's police chief has a warning for those involved in those ongoing protests that occasionally damage property and target police officers with violence. And we're getting a better idea as to why so many officers are leaving the force. Here's KYRadio's Hannah Scott joining us live. Hannah.
Yeah, Dave, we heard a lot from interim police chief, Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz yesterday. Of course, leading up to today is the one of the first days that the Seattle City Council is going to take a deep dive into the budget with their own proposals as opposed to Mayor Durkin's as it relates to anything funding-wise for the Seattle Police Department. So there's been a lot of information coming out of the mayor's office and Seattle Police over the last several days. Yesterday, though, as we had talked on the show yesterday about some of the recent arrests, including the person who was arrested for being accused of hitting that officer with a bat. Chief Diaz said yesterday, basically, look, we're not going to tolerate this kind of activity. It's just not going to happen. He pointed to a handful of recent arrests as evidence of the problem with the violence.
Jacob Greenberg is charged with assault in the first degree for hitting an SPD officer in the head with a metal bat so hard during a riot that the officer's helmet was cracked. According to the charging documents, after the brutal attack, the 19-year-old from Kirkland expressed remorse, not for potentially fatally assaulting itself, but for the fact that the officer was wearing a helmet that most likely saved his life. Greenberg also texted a friend that he would like to, and I quote, slit every SPD throat. That friend, 29-year-old Danielle McMillan of Woodinville, and Greenberg are also charged with the firebomb attacks on the East Precinct and the Seattle Police Officers Guild.
Now, he really wanted to highlight those kind of threats or text messages and things that were said to kind of show what officers are up against out there in even some of these smaller demonstrations that still go on pretty much nightly. In another case,
20-year-old Jonathan Duger of Olympia is also in jail, charged with arson for throwing a flaming object with an ignited fuse into a Capitol Hills coffee shop that caused an immediate explosion. Luckily, no one was hurt. But this disregard for people's lives and safety by throwing flaming objects into a business, this can't be our new normal. Businesses, small and large, are struggling during this pandemic, and it's completely unacceptable that this is an ongoing violence is only compounding their challenges. I want to address these recent arrests to let you know the Seattle Police Department continues to serve and protect this city.
And the chief admits that they've changed some of the way they've been responding to these demonstrations.
All people of Seattle deserve to be safe in the city, whether they're exercising the First Amendment right of freedom of speech, visiting a cafe, living their lives, or walking to work. And all of our SPD officers deserve to be safe on the job, too. Our community deserves to be treated fairly, equitably, and with respect. Because arming yourself, in this case, a baseball bat, winding up, taking a swing, and landing a direct hit to the head of anyone, including a Seattle police officer, is a brutal crime, a potential fatal crime. This is not a peaceful protest. This is not civil disobedience. This is illegal, and this is violence. You will be arrested.
And that was really his overall message, and he pointed to some of the variety of things that they had heard. He said they have about 50 officers now out on average nightly with some of these demonstrations. There was another one last night, I believe it was over by the Aurora Bridge, where they was the everyday marchers who tend to be out every day, hung a banner, I believe it said abolish the police or abolish SPD over the Aurora Bridge in that area last night. And there was no violence or arrest that I saw last night, but we saw some over the weekend, and there's already some movement about some events coming up this weekend. So he was really trying to send a strong message that they weren't going to take that anymore, that they were going to investigate, arrest, and hold people accountable, including sharing information with the federal government. I asked him about that, and he said yes. And I believe actually one, if not both, of those particular cases are being referred to the federal government right now. And he said all of this really takes a toll on officers who are out there trying to protect the city while putting their own lives on the line.
I want to make sure that they're protected. I want to make sure that they have the ability to go safely home to their families at the end of the day. But, you know, they're actually, people are going out because they want to take care of their officers. They want to take care of the community. And, you know, we have had some officers leave the department. I understand, you know, some of their concern. Many of those concerns were at the very beginning of the discussion of defunding the police department. So people didn't know if they were going to have a job in a couple months. And so they started testing for other agencies because they thought maybe I wasn't going to have a job in 2 months or 3 months. And so we did see quite a few leave in the month of September.
And I got a chance to look at some of the exit interviews, and I know I shared some of those with you, Dave, yesterday. And what did you think? Did you get a chance to read them?
Yeah, I sure did. Some of the complaints included political mayhem, Marxist collaborations, lack of leadership. When you handcuff your officers for political reasons, it's extremely demoralizing. We are not racist. We do not hate homeless people. We aren't weirded out by LGBTQ people. We are human, etc.
Yes, absolutely. And well, I think one person, and a lot of those, I don't know if you looked at how long some of those folks had been on the job. There were many who were 20 years plus on the job who were just like, it's not worth it for me to do this and put myself on the line anymore with this kind of treatment. Others who said, I don't recognize this department after 31 years. I don't know what this department is anymore. I do want to point out there was some more positive statements, people who just kind of called it a career and said, you know, it was I really enjoyed my time here. So it wasn't, you know, all negative. The one overwhelming thing that struck me, though, that I think just universally almost everyone said, nearly everyone, that their favorite thing about their job was the camaraderie, the officers, the people that they worked with, which I thought was something good.
They met great people both at the department and members of the public. But even some of those people came back to the politics of the Seattle City Council, just not feeling the support and, of course, worried about job insecurity. And it's interesting. Some of them are going to places like Wenatchee, Federal Way, Everett, the ATF, federal government, the FBI. So they're staying in law enforcement, but they just found something about the atmosphere here too toxic in several cases.
And it's negative. And I was thinking about this morning, you know, and I don't have a job where I necessarily put my life on the line, but I like to feel like I'm doing a good job when I go to work, right?
Everybody does.
I can't imagine the sustained negativity that those officers must feel, those officers who aren't bad actors, who are just out there doing their job. That's got to take a toll. So it seems like that's a lot of what's going on.
By the way,
what
baseball
I read.
Bat guy's in jail, right?
He is in jail, $750,000, and I do believe he's going to be transferred to the feds, I'm pretty sure is what they said yesterday.
And the torch person's also in jail?
Yes, absolutely still in jail. And most of those firebombing-type charges are also federal charges now.
Right.
And, so they'll be in jail for a while.
All right. Thank you, Hannah.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. Last month, a young boy developed an unbreakable bond with we'll call it a unique object. And sometimes kindness comes straight from mom when she allows it. CBS's Steve Hartman is on the road with the story of the innocence of young love.
It's hard being an only child.
Put the dirt in there.
Especially during a pandemic. Which may explain why 2-year-old Theo Brady of Salt Lake City, Utah, recently felt a strange attraction to a Halloween decoration.
I think he got kind of lonely and he found this skeleton and was like, oh, this can be my friend.
So, to placate her son, Abigail Brady agreed to something utterly ridiculous.
Like, I was just swallowed all my pride and was like, you know, if this makes my son happy, I'm going to do it.
Do what, you ask? Take them on a play date to the beach. Abigail was secretly hoping that would be the end of it. But the pair hit it off famously, and for the last month, Theo and the skeleton, who they named Benny, have been joined at the hip bone, dining together, dressing up as ghosts, and winding down at the end of a hauntingly long day.
Yeah, some weird way it's comforting. He likes to read Benny books, which is so cute and creepy but cute.
Are you excited to take Benny to the grocery store?
Creepy but cute.
Yay.
It's not exactly what most parents want for a baby's first bromance, but the bond is undeniable. No bones about it. Whether they're at the market or on the playground, if not for a lack of an epidermis, you'd swear this skeleton was Theo's brother from another mummy.
Yay.
In fact, at times, Benny almost seemed happy.
Look.
His humorous, clearly showing. And who wouldn't want this kind of friend for their child?
He just sees the skeleton as someone that needs love.
Yeah, I think it's fine. Unless he starts walking around with a casket.
Yeah, then that's like, oh my gosh, too far.
But for now, it's nothing to be scared of.
That's okay.
In fact, this October especially, I think we could all benefit from a little less fright. and a lot more.
Oh, you're so nice.
Friendly. Steve Hartman, CBS News, on the road.
And like, it's a giant skeleton, too. I mean, because Benny looks maybe about three, and the skeleton is a full-size skeleton.
Yeah, well, whatever.
So it's sitting in the grocery cart as she's pushing them along, and Benny's trying to feed, or no, the skeleton is Benny, I forget, but the young boy's trying to feed him an avocado.
I don't believe skeletons can actually digest avocados.
Well, don't tell the young kid that.
Okay.
You're too logical, Mr. Ross.
Yeah, I know. Now here he is from Gian Ursula G. Scott. I know a lot of us were withholding judgment on the Biden tax plan until we heard what 50 Cent thought about it. And now we know. Apparently he does. Well, first of all, 50 Cent, as I recall, is a very famous rapper, correct?
Yeah, famous rapper. He has now turned his into, like, does film now. He has a show, Power. That's been a success for him. And so he's kind of getting into the TV movie world.
Mm-hmm. He does not like the tax plan.
He does not. He definitely does not. He even doubled down on that this morning, where he took to Twitter and he actually said, hey, I don't want to be 25 cents compared to this tax plan. Quote, yes. Yeah, I don't want to be 20 cent. 62% is very, yeah, very bad idea. I don't like it. And then, of course, he promotes his ABC for life November 18th. Here's what's disappointing about this coming from 50. I actually think 50 Cent is a genius. I think he's a very smart man, so much so that I read his book. And in his book, he actually tells you the reasons why he does things. He tells you why he had the beef with Oprah. He said, what could I lose? What could I lose starting a beef with Oprah? In the end, no matter what, even if you agree or disagree with him, it helped get him clicks. It helped people get to know who 50 was. He started a beef with Floyd Mayweather, which, by the way, I don't like Floyd Mayweather either. But anyways, he did.
So you think he's doing this for
Absolutely.
Attention?
He's doing this for attention. It is a win-win. Now you have Eric Trump on Twitter, which that's the son that Donald never really mentions. Anyways, you have Eric Trump on Twitter says, two great, courageous Americans. And he has a picture of Ice Cube and 50 and actually has a Photoshop Trump on their hats as they sit together. So 50 absolutely knows what he's doing. Most of 50's followers won't even make $400,000 a year. The reason why 50 is famous and the reason we know who he is today come from people who don't make $400,000 a year or more. Now here he is using this time just 14 days before the election to do this. Notice he does this on the heels of Ice Cube doing this. Mm-hmm. Ice Cube is getting clicks. Now all of a sudden 50's going to get clicks. And guess what? 50 knows. He knows that Black America will not stop watching what he does. He's seen Kanye do it. Kanye can drop an album tomorrow and people will still listen to it. You want me to prove my point? R. Kelly. R. Kelly for years sold out concerts even though people knew what he had done. That's what 50 is banking on. This is an opportunity for him to tap into people that would never know who he was, would never retweet him at all. But guess what? In conservative America, 50 Cent and Ice Cube are big deals right now. Huh. Interesting. Why are they big deals all of a sudden right now?
Because they're against the Biden tax plan.
Oh, Dave, sometimes the way you put things, you kind of settle me down, brother.
So how do you feel about it? How do you feel about the Biden tax plan?
I mean, I feel that any dollar, $50 or $100 over $400,000 that you make in a year, I feel like go ahead and tax it. Tax it.
You're okay with that?
Yes, I'm okay with it. I've been talking to athletes that make more than $400,000 a year, and yeah, the ones that I talk to are okay with it. And,
really?
And here's why. Because they have family still. Most of these guys that I talk to that make over the $400,000 a year, when they talk to me, there's nobody else in their family that makes that. Like, Dave, let me ask you this. Is there anybody in your family that makes over $400,000 a year?
Not on my side. I think on my wife's side, perhaps.
Okay, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Not in my family as well. So a lot of these athletes or entertainers, they don't have anybody else in their family that makes $400,000 a year. And isn't it interesting that whenever there is some type of plan or some proposal, it's always a black entertainer that's being asked. Remember Steve Harvey in 2016? How did that work out? Remember Jim Brown in 2016? Here we are with Ice Cube. Does anybody actually think something's going to get done? You mean to tell me that Ice Cube and others really believe that President Donald Trump is going to help him out with a $500 billion platinum plan?
I don't know.
No. So you ask me how I feel about it. I feel as if it is upsetting for these entertainers to continue doing this 14 days before the election, and this is what they do.
G and Ursula, 9 o'clock on Kye Radio. Thank you, G.
Tuesday mornings, we go live to Washington, D.C., and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post. Let's talk about this Hunter Biden story, which various social media decided, oh, we better censor this because it's not accurate, and yet it is now probably the most clicked story on the Internet. So give me your take on this, David. You're used to checking out stuff and trying to assess what's fraudulent and what's not. Does this smack of fraud to you or not?
It just doesn't seem like it's as important as people have made it out to be. I should say I haven't written anything about this, but our fact checker, the Post fact checker, has looked at it and found it to be, the providence is very dubious here. Even Rudy Giuliani says it's 50-50. He's working with Russian spies on this. And also the things that people claim the documents show, there's really no evidence that it does show. It shows something that Hunter Biden might have done, but really nothing to show that Joe Biden did anything wrong.
So even if this meeting took place, do we know if the meeting with Joe took place at all?
What I've read, no. I should say there was a great story about this, the writing of this story within the New York Post. The New York Post is the first one to publish this, but they had to basically find a reporter to put their byline on us because the person who wrote it didn't want their byline on it because he had lots of doubts about it.
Yeah, that tells you something when the reporter who worked on it doesn't want his name associated with it. All right, so let's talk about your byline. You've been looking into State Department records. You've been trying to find out how much the State Department has been spending on Trump's properties, and tell us the significance of that.
Well, one thing we really ought to know but don't is how much money the taxpayers have paid President Trump's private property since he became president. We know it's at least $1.2 million because Trump, when he goes to his properties, then charges the government for the rooms the Secret Service uses, the rooms the State Department uses, things like that. But we don't really so he's created this sort of closed loop where he can bring taxpayer money to himself and nobody on the outside can see how much there is. We're trying to bring some light to that before the election. So we've gotten some records just in the last couple of days that when your readers, when your listeners read them, you'll be amazed. And we just got some amazing stuff last night on this.
Well, how amazing? Give us a hint. What do you mean amazed?
Just a little hint. Give you one hint. President Trump, when he meets with a foreign leader at his property, often there's a bilateral meeting. It's a ritual of diplomacy where the two men sit down with just a glass of water next to them and talk about whatever the issues are between their two countries. Yeah. President Trump's club charged the United States government for the water he drank.
For the water he drank? How much does the water
cost? For the water.
Like $3 a bottle?
$3 a glass.
$3 a glass? Really? Seriously?
$3 a glass for water. Yeah. Wow. Must be great water.
I hope it's been filtered. Okay. All right, so you get to document 450 pages of that. You have such an exciting job.
It's a great job, man. I was up late last night trying to make sense of all this stuff. It's a nice feeling to know that we're going to have, not the full picture, because they won't give us the full picture, but a much clearer picture for readers before Election Day.
Good. Well, I don't want to be giving those foreign leaders any free water. That's for darn sure. Okay. The upcoming debate, they're going to mute the mic, apparently, during the two-minute statements. But I guess they're not going to mute it during the discussion so that you can still have interruptions, right?
Yeah. I mean, I thought the two-minute mute is, maybe it'll allow for some uninterrupted discussion. But, the whole debate depends on the goodwill of the two participants. If somebody's going to just interrupt all the time, unless you like make them fall through a trapdoor or put them in a soundproof box, I don't see how you can really stop that from happening. You really shouldn't. I mean, these people want to be president of the United States, so their own self-control should be part of what you learn from one of these debates.
Yeah. The Biden tax plan. Now, we're getting more details on this, and it does look like what he says is true, that it falls most heavily on people making over $400,000 a year. But there is this this concern growing that over time, that's going to creep down to affect people making lower incomes. I guess what I'm asking you is, are people going to vote for Biden based on this tax plan, or does the choice in this election transcend these specific policies?
I don't think that many people are going to make the decision based on Biden's tax plan. A, tax plans, especially ones that raise taxes on anyone, are really hard to get through. But B, you know, the stakes in this election, I think, are probably, the stakes people are voting on are probably the pandemic, the economy, climate change, you know, things that are more sort of visceral than the tax plan.
Yeah. What do you think about the early voting turnout? I must admit, I knew there was a lot of energy in this election, a lot at stake, but I'm really shocked by the high numbers.
It's huge. In my home state of Texas, I think they've been setting records every single day. I mean, I think like 4 million Texans have already voted. It's like, you know, some huge, like 40% of the total vote, not just the early vote, but the total vote from 2016. So I think the Democrats did a good job. There's a lot of energy. Democrats also did a good job encouraging people to vote by mail or to vote absentee. That was their strategy. They've been pushing it for months. Trump, on the other hand, has been doing the opposite, telling us people just to vote on election day. So for the Democrats, that's a good strategy because, you know, if your people are sort of on the margins about whether they'll vote, now you've given them many more chances to do it. If you're Trump and you're putting all your eggs in the basket of election day, if there's a COVID spike, if there's a, you know, rainstorm, if there's some kind of problem, you don't get a second chance.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. Watch your Washington Post feed for news on how much we're charging foreign leaders for water. That'll be coming up in the next few days. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Here we go. Let's go. Choke points. You never know what you're going to find when you start digging in the Seattle area, and the same is true when you go underwater. And contractors have now found a previously uncharted wreck in Lake Union, right where the Fairview Avenue Bridge is now located. Here's Chris.
Yep, divers have found more than 75 wrecks at the bottom of Lake Union over time. Most of them have been charted, but only a handful have been identified. So you can imagine the surprise when contractors removing old timber pilings that held up part of the Fairview Avenue Bridge found a wreck that they weren't expecting.
People have gone through and mapped some of the sunken ships that are on the bottom of Lake Union. The one that we found, though, was not mapped. So it was a complete surprise. So it had been cut in half and then deliberately sunk some time ago. I think, what do we think, 70 years ago or so?
Project manager Marilyn Yim says the wood wreck is about 25 feet long, 25 feet wide. It was close to the north end of the bridge, kind of near the Seattle Seaplanes moorage.
We tried to see if there was any kind of, you know, distinctive markings, anything that might be special about it. That was part of the archaeological and historical evaluation of the find.
The archaeologists didn't find anything distinctive, and there was enough room between it and the bridge that it was left where it was. A popular diving selfie spot, though, near a submerged Harley-Davidson, will not get to stay. The motorcycle had to be pulled from the water.
Divers used to know where it was and go visit it from time to time. And so, unfortunately, that was one of the pieces of debris that we had to remove in cleaning up underneath the bridge.
As for the project itself, Yim hopes to have the bridge open in early spring, about a year and a half after it closed. It's been a somewhat challenging project considering the amount of room that they have down there, and working over the water is never easy.
We have the landmark, you know, historic steam plant building on one side. We have high voltage power lines on the other. And, you know, they can't really approach everything from the water by barge. They can't do everything from the land. And so, you know, it's been a little bit tricky and challenging to build this thing.
But the project is on schedule, and Yim says it will be a much different looking bridge when finished.
It used to look like a big forest of timber piles from the old timber bridge that we removed. And so actually it'll be about, you know, three mid-span piers with columns, a lot of open space underneath there.
This was the last woodpile bridge in use in Seattle. The new bridge will have wider lanes, a full sidewalk, a protected bike lane, also have a couple of bump outs where people can hang out and just kind of look over the water without blocking the sidewalk. The popular floating walkway will also return. It'll be one of the last features added to this project. As for getting around this thing, there was a big concern on the front end that this was going to cause a huge problem because this is a big backdoor route to get away from South Lake Union without using Mercer or I-5. You can get between South Lake Union and the U District really quickly by basically coming through our neighborhood here through East Lake. And apparently the traffic detour that has worked pretty well, that takes you through Fred Hutch. They had basically wanted locals only in buses to use that. And because the lack of traffic during COVID has actually made that detour work quite well. About 9,000 vehicles a day used to use the Fairview corridor in the pre-COVID days. It's a popular way, as I said, to get out of Southlake Union. Another 8,000 bus riders use that corridor. So that detour has been working, but we should get our bridge back late March, early April.
Wow. All right, very good. Does the is the Harley worth any have any historical value? Is it going to be on display anywhere?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what they're going to do with it. I put the pictures of it up at mynorthwest.com. I'll ask Marilyn, you know, what the project manager, what they might do with it. I'm not sure if it's valuable enough to end up at Mohai like the elephant neon sign.
Don't tell Felix.
But he'll want it. Well, yeah. We know where it is and we've got it. So maybe the contractor will keep it.
You can ring my
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. There have been calls to reform the police so that we don't just send a cop to every domestic situation. We also send a social worker. But it takes a special kind of training for social workers to be comfortable in such a situation. And that's what Rachel Bell's looking into.
That's right. So there is a brand new certificate that's being offered by Shoreline Community College. And we're proud to say here in the region that it is the first of its kind in the nation. So it's a 15-credit certificate that was developed and is being taught by Anura Shaw. She is a forensic social worker who also teaches crisis intervention training to law enforcement officers in Washington State. So this certificate, it bridges the gap between criminal justice and sociology, also law and psychology, and it would greatly benefit a social worker who wants to work alongside police to help mentally ill and marginalized populations.
Something is very wrong with our system when you can have someone who is cycling in and out of the justice system, in and out of mental health court, in and out of hospitals, over and over and over, and nothing seems to work. And so this has been a long-standing problem in our society, and I think everyone can agree that there needs to be some sweeping change when it comes to individuals who are just kind of left out there on the fringe of society with not a lot of support. What I teach is that this is all related. The healthcare system is related to the justice system, which is related to our education system. I teach my students and I teach the professionals that you cannot resolve one issue without looking at the entire gamut of how individuals interact with multiple systems across our nation.
So the course explores de-escalation and conflict resolution, but it also spends a lot of time looking at social justice and race.
You know, why is JonBenet Ramsey's name? Why am I able to just, you know, say that as if it's, you know, my best friend next door? But a lot of us cannot even name one of the 10,000 missing or murdered Indigenous women in the state. That's what I teach about. Like, why is that happening? What's the deeper meaning behind that?
She also teaches history to give better context to issues that are happening today.
I have my students read about the Tuskegee experiments, a public health department that experimented without consent on Black males when it came to syphilis. A lot of times they were not told they had the disease. They were not given the right medications. Syphilis causes blindness. There were hundreds and hundreds of African-American males that were experimented on without their consent and that died because they were not treated. And people often wonder, why aren't there more Black women signing up for the COVID vaccine trials? Well, here's one of the reasons why. Unfortunately, Rachel, you know, I don't think that that's taught in school.
Several years ago, Shoreline, Lake Forest Park, Bothell, Kirkland, and Kenmore police departments banded together to create what's called the North Sound Radar. It's a program that connects police officers with mental health professionals that they call navigators who can respond to a scene and help a person with behavioral health issues. But for all of those cities, five police jurisdictions, there are only four part-time navigators. So Shoreline Police Chief Sean Letford said this certificate will be a big help.
Very beneficial to have these mental health professionals come out with a better understanding of law enforcement policies and procedures. It's hard to attract mental health professionals. You know, maybe they have a full-time established job because they have to come out and work weekends and holidays, and especially with Shoreline Community College and how they're putting these programs together. We're going to see a much more robust partnership between mental health professionals and law enforcement.
Like I said, this certificate is the first of its kind in the country and will hopefully lead to new jobs being created.
You know, we have to remember that this is a brand new career. And so the good news about Washington State is that we do have a number of positions that are just opening up, things like peer support professionals, which are specifically recruiting individuals who have a lived experience with mental health issues, who can be a peer to an individual who's really struggling right now, who needs to be lifted up. all the way to, you know, the seasoned social worker or counselor, you know, mental health professional. And this is appealing to them because I believe that my programs will rapidly open the doors for other agencies who maybe never even thought that this could have been a career.
So Honora developed two programs, one for students who are just, you know, getting ready to get into their careers. And then there's a professional development series for people who already do this work, whether they're in social work or a judge or a police officer.
When will we know how many signups she's getting?
Oh, I guess I could check in with her because the class has started since I spoke with her. So yeah, I'll have to check in and see.
Because that's the key here, right? It sounds like a great program, but it also sounds like a really challenging career, the kind of thing that you really can't, you know, leave at the office when you come home at night.
Yeah, but I think this will appeal to a lot of people with what's going on right now, because there's plenty of people who go into social work and think of how many young people are so concerned with social justice who have been out marching the past several months.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a way to actually make change
point,
in that job.
Good idea. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
It's a hospital we've all heard of where children get life-saving care and no child is turned away. Heather Bosch as our October Charity of the Month.
I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease lymphoma when I was 17 years old.
Rebecca Jacobson says she was successfully treated at Mary Bridge Children's Hospital in Tacoma and not long after went to college out of state.
But when I was in Idaho, I realized really quickly that I needed follow-up care.
We don't often recognize that so much work has to happen afterward.
Dr. Tamara Chang.
And that often is the time when families and children and young people need even more support.
Dr. Chang works with the Mary Bridge Children's Cancer Survivorship Program, which provides follow-up cancer screenings, emotional support, nutrition advice, and more. It's one of the hospital's many programs, and it's funded with money raised by the Mary Bridge Children's Foundation. Executive Director Alicia Chapman says the goal:
no child is turned away and they get the life-saving care that they need.
The foundation helps cover the costs of treatment, follow-up, and unique programs from leading-edge cancer care to a nationally recognized child abuse intervention department. The foundation even has a program that helps cover the extra costs that come up while a child is receiving care.
Something as simple as an overnight hotel stay, transportation to get to and from an appointment. It might also help with prescription costs and might help with food.
The Mary Bridge Children's Hospital and Health Network serves close to 500,000 kids each year, powered by donations raised by its foundation.
I feel like I am only alive because of the generosity and the support of other people.
All right, there's Heather Bosch. You can find out more about Mary Bridge Children's Hospital at mynorthwest.com. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at mynorthwest.com.